Are you an optimist or a pessimist? Depending on your answer, you may be excited about a world of technological innovation and change, or terrified of a bleak future on an unlivable Earth. Here with a balanced vision of what's to come is Jay Ingram, author of the new book, The Future of Us: The Science of What We'll Eat, Where We'll Live, and Who We'll Be. Jay is a best-selling science author and broadcaster who has hosted two national science programs in Canada. In 2015, he won the Walter C. Alvarez Award from the American Medical Writers Association for excellence in communicating healthcare developments and concepts to the public. Here he is to share five of his big ideas.
Hello, I'm Jay Ingram, a science writer and broadcaster. My latest book is The Future of Us. I've selected five insights from the range of topics in the book. Insight number one, what can we do about climate change? The starting point here is that the carbon dioxide we are emitting traps the energy of sunlight and warms the atmosphere and the Earth. The easiest and cheapest way to address this would be to reduce our emissions, but we're obviously not very good at that. Beyond that, there are two main technological approaches. You can either try to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, or ignore the gas and lower the temperature instead. We can reduce carbon dioxide by capturing it and burying it underground. This can be done right at the source, like the smokestack, where CO2 can be 15 to 20% of the total emissions. But so far, the impact of this has been minimal. A more expensive and more challenging version is called direct air capture. This is an attempt to remove carbon dioxide not as it's being emitted, but from the air around us. And this is much more challenging. The concentration of CO2 in the air around you is not 15 to 20%, but only 0.04%. There are some pilot plants underway that can do this, but building their numbers and capacity to the point where they make significant inroads into the amount of atmospheric carbon dioxide is a long way away. So yes, we should be doing much more of this. Time is the issue. The other approach is to ignore carbon dioxide and focus instead on the heating of the planet. If incoming sunlight could be reflected or absorbed in some way before it can dump energy into the atmosphere, temperatures would fall. It's been suggested this could be done by painting roofs white or making clouds more reflective. But the most discussed and most controversial version involves loading the upper atmosphere with sulfates or other molecules. These would scatter some sunlight back into space and cool the Earth. We know this works because of volcanoes. After the eruption of Mount Pinatubo in 1991, global temperatures dropped 2 degrees Celsius. But politics could dramatically complicate the picture. Say country A wants to cool down, so they inject sulfates into the atmosphere, but neighboring country B's precipitation changes dramatically as a result and ruins their crops. Climate wars. And finally, the big risk is that any technology to intercept sunlight might be used as an excuse to continue to burn fossil fuels. Why would we need to stop if we can just control the temperature? But if the temperature controls were turned off, the accumulated carbon dioxide would blow the lid off the temperature records. Insight number two. The global population should reach nearly 10 billion by the year 2050. That's an increase of 25% from today. But when it comes to food, we're told we'll have to produce 50% more food than today. 25% more people, 50% more food. Why? Well, partly the greater population, of course, but partly because of rising standards of living. Historically, the higher the standard of living, the greater the consumption of meat. But can we possibly keep up with that? What we've achieved with a domestic chicken is the perfect example. The average supermarket chicken today is 4 times as big as its 1950s counterpart. Yet, the demand for more chicken meat continues. It doesn't seem possible that the birds can continue to grow. Today's nestling chick is converted into a 5-pound adult in just 6 weeks. The modern chicken breast is 80% bigger than it was a few decades ago. The faster the bird grows and the heavier it gets, the further removed from nature it becomes. And I can't really see how the trend can continue for humane reasons either. As it is, factory farm chicken today may live its life in an area the size of an 8.5 by 11 inch piece of paper. They develop myriad health issues related to their unnatural size too. Could the chicken reach a dead end? I'm sure there will always be chickens, but it's hard to see how much further they can go. What about substitutes? Plant-based chicken, possible, but requiring a pretty significant cultural shift. Lab-grown chicken meat, a great idea, in my opinion, but very early in its development. Lab-grown chicken has been okayed in the United States, and chicken nuggets are already being sold in Singapore. What about substituting protein by eating insects? Talk about cultural shifts. We have to remember, though, in North America that hundreds of millions of people incorporate insect protein into their diets. One technology that's not going to solve this problem is an actual one, an array of robots that can more efficiently remove the meat from a chicken carcass. Insight number three. Elon Musk recently announced that his company Neuralink was looking to recruit their first human subject for a brain implant. Typical subject might be someone who's lost the ability to speak after a stroke or neuromuscular disease. The implant is about the size of a dime, made of metal, and once it's set in the skull, its 1,000 or so electrodes begin to record the brain activity of the subject. The goal is to train up a computer to recognize what the patient is trying to do or say and intervene to make that happen, whether it's moving a cursor or generating spoken words. Not surprisingly, Musk didn't stop there. He went on to elaborate that the implant would bring us a step closer to, and I quote, enhancing broadband connections between humans or between humans and AI, unquote. What does that mean? The human-to-human part boggles my mind, maybe because I don't have an implant. Does that mean I'd know what you're thinking? Or worse, you'd know what I'm thinking? But the human-to-AI claim is consistent with what a number of technophiles, and some who aren't tech-savvy at all, would like to accomplish in the long term. That is, establish a robust connection between a human brain and AI such that the entire contents of the brain could be uploaded to the cloud. And that person would then exist in two forms, biological and technological. Just another bunch more ones and zeros. Is this even possible? It is already possible with brain implants to understand a person's thoughts to some extent and translate them, but there are many hurdles. Ones and zeros do not replicate the working of the brain in any way, despite what chatbots might have persuaded you. And while you could argue that the calculating speed of the brain is well within the capacity of computers, the range of human thought might not be. Founding editor of Wired magazine, Kevin Kelly, is certain about that. He says, "No one entity will do all that we do better." Insight number four. If you write a book about the future, you have no choice. You must write about the flying car. I know, it's been a joke for decades. Where is the flying car? The Jetsons had them. The thing is, it's probably within reach, at least technologically, but it might be out of reach for reasons that are beyond its control. First, there have been flying cars for more than a century. The first was built in 1917, just 9 years after the Wright brothers flew for the first time. It was called the autoplane. There were sporadic attempts after that, one of the most successful being the Aerobeale, powered by a Studebaker car engine. The car company bought 5 of them. These vehicles looked about as weird as a hybrid car airplane could. Imagine a small car, giant wings, and a long tail. There's no way you would have been able to back it out of the driveway, taxi down the street, and take off. Imagine parallel parking. They also required a skill set way beyond a driver's license. The technology challenge is that flying and driving put different demands on a vehicle. Planes must be light to be able to generate lots of lift. Cars must be heavy to prevent lift and stay on the ground. It's no problem for cars to carry a lot of fuel, whether that's gas or electricity. Because of the weight, planes can't afford to carry loads of fuel. And speaking of fuel, in an era of climate change, creating a whole new set of vehicles burning fossil fuel makes no sense. And batteries are not yet energy intense enough to be practical. They lose charge too fast. And finally, who's going to want or need one? Rich city folk? Maybe, but they could just use a self-driving car. Rich country folk? Again, maybe, but if they just take their flying car to the nearest landing site, then switch to a non-flying car? What's the point? Insight number 5. The world's wildlife is doing poorly. Just the other day, a study revealed that 41% of the world's amphibians are threatened with extinction. And that's just one study. You'd think any move to restore a healthy biosphere should be applauded. But maybe not always. There's a lot of interest right now in something called de-extinction, bringing back a species that has gone extinct. How could you possibly do that? That's a good question. You have to be able to salvage genetic material from remains, whether they're museum skins or fossil bones. And that's just the start. You then have to somehow create a fertilized egg, find some sort of modern surrogate mother, and hope, after a long, involved, and technically hugely demanding process, you get a viable embryo. But a better question than how is why. I wish sometimes someone would just say, "We're doing this because it's cool." But no, what you usually hear is an elaborate environmental justification. The woolly mammoth gets most of the publicity, but let's take the passenger pigeon instead. In the mid-19th century, the skies over the U.S. and Canada were darkened by their flocks, sometimes a billion strong. Even so, it didn't take long for human greed to wipe them out. The last individual died in a zoo in 1911. But in earlier decades, their sheer numbers made them an environmental force. Giant flocks would descend on the forests of the northeast to feed, bringing down branches, covering the ground with guano, and opening up clearings, allowing the forest to regenerate. It's thought the passenger pigeon was essential to forest health. That's the why. The justification for trying to bring them back is to re-establish those giant flocks and bring back forest health. But even if you get through all the hurdles I just alluded to, even getting one nestling, you're still nowhere. You need hundreds hatching at about the same time to ensure the old social habits could be re-established. And pretty soon after that, you'd need thousands, tens of thousands. How would you train them to migrate in the same old patterns? Would today's forests react the same way? What would we do? You know, I'd love to see a living passenger pigeon as much as anyone, but there are too many existing species that need our attention.
Thank you, Jay. That was Jay Ingram with 5 big ideas from The Future of Us, the science of what we'll eat, where we'll live, and who we'll be. You might also like our book bite for 2030, How Today's Biggest Trends Will Collide and Reshape the Future of Everything by Mauro Guillen. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.